This is KGNU's Morning Magazine for Wednesday, May 11th of 2022. I'm your host, Hannah Stewart. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, we'll take a look at what happens to debris removed from neighborhoods affected by the Marshall Fire. Western Colorado University has launched a project to repurpose discarded solar panels to help refugees charge their phones. As always on Wednesday morning, Chris Moore will share his commentary, Make Them Hear You. And then herbalist Brigitte Mars will bring us her regular Wednesday feature, Naturally. A BBC News update is at the bottom of the hour, then it's the Hightower Lowdown. In the first half of A Public Affair, Elena Claver will speak with local author and longtime KGNU volunteer, Len Barron, about his new book. Then at 9 a.m., news director Shannon Young interviews Atlanta-based author and environmental attorney Justine Cowan about her book, The Secret Life of Dorothy Soames. Following that, at 9:30, Shauna Sprouls will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. That's all still ahead this morning, but first a look at the headlines with KGNU's Kiara Damari.
Today is the final scheduled day of Colorado's legislative session. In the past 24 hours, a number of bills have passed or been shot down. After a vote of 35-30, the fentanyl bill that would have increased criminal penalties for fentanyl possession has been sent back to committee, a win for lawmakers who argue that increased punishment would not work to curb addiction. A bill to protect car owners from predatory towing practices has also passed. The bill, HB22-1314, is adding rules to tow truck companies. Some of the rules include that the tow truck driver must take a photo of the car being towed and why, get authorization from property owners 24 hours before the tow, and give a 24-hour written notice before conducting the tow. If they fail to complete any of these, the tow truck company may not charge or retain any fees. The Senate also passed a bill that regulates law on visitor rights at hospitals during the pandemic. Healthcare facilities must have written policies and procedures for visiting rights. It also prohibits facilities from solely making rules to stop the spread of the pandemic. In the final days of the session, Colorado Republicans, a minority in both chambers, paused the final flurry of activity with an extended filibuster. This forced Democrats to concede on a list of bills, including one that would have prevented police from lying to children in order to get confessions, a bill to curb greenhouse gas emissions, labor rights for government employees, language concerning the replacement of racist school mascots, and finally, a bill to end filibusters. Other bills that passed Tuesday include HB22-1414, which will put a school lunch measure on the November's ballot. If it passes, the measure will come into effect for the 2023 through 2024 school year. The measure calls for an income tax on people making more than $300,000 a year to fund free school lunches for public school students. Advocates say they saw nearly a 40% increase in participation in the school lunch program after the federal government made it free at the start of COVID-19. In other legislative news, the flavored tobacco and nicotine ban was shot down yesterday. A January statewide poll showed that 80% of Colorado voters are concerned about the dangers of young people smoking cigarettes, using e-cigarettes, and nicotine vaping. But the bill died in committee this session. Colorado experienced very little snow this winter, and what it did get is melting at an extreme rate. Becky Bollinger of the Colorado Climate Center told the Denver Post they should still have about 8.5 inches of snowpack, and they're at 2 inches. The quickly melting snow will continue to affect Colorado's climate and may even affect the agriculture industry. A visiting CU Boulder professor used CU email to advise legislator on challenging the 2020 election result. KGNU's James Swenson has more.
John Eastman is a lawyer who represented former President Donald Trump following his loss during the 2020 election. Eastman was a visiting CU Boulder professor who used his CU email to advise a Pennsylvania lawmaker on how to challenge that state's electors. The Denver Post obtained messages to and from Eastman's CU email account during the January 6th House committee investigation. According to the Denver Post, in addition to demonstrating how Eastman advised Pennsylvania State Republican Russ Diamond on challenging that state's results, The emails show CU Boulder reimbursed Eastman for around $500 for a trip he took to Philadelphia shortly after the November 2020 election to participate in an academic conference put on by his department, the Bruce D. Benson Center for the Study of Western Civilization. This visit is how Eastman began advising Trump on how to stay in office. He met with Trump's team at a hotel while they were putting together a legal brief to challenge the election results in Pennsylvania. According to the same Denver Post article, he previously has defended his action in advising Trump and has threatened to sue CU for what he characterizes as retaliation for constitutionally protected First Amendment activities. For KGNU, I'm James Swenson.
Around 3:15 p.m. yesterday morning, a fire was reported on 47th Street. The fire was started by a power pole and grew to be anywhere from 100 to 150 square feet. There were no injuries or structures lost, as the fire was extinguished fairly fast. Workers at another Colorado Starbucks in Denver have voted to unionize. The vote by the workers at the Colfax and Milwaukee store in Denver was a unanimous 13-0 in favor of forming a union. Since this time last year, workers at more than 60 Starbucks locations nationwide have unionized. Today in Boulder is going to be cloudy in the mid-70s to low 80s. Outside the studio, it's 48 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Chiara Damari.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Large-scale cleanup is finally underway for properties completely destroyed by the Marshall Fire. As part of our 2022 Follow the Waste Stream series, KGNU's Stacy Johnson examines what all goes into removing the debris from Colorado's most destructive urban fire, and if any of that material can get a second life.
As the activity of heavy machinery grinding away and semi-trucks with long trailers are snaking their way through the neighborhoods of the Marshall Fire Zone, some may be asking how exactly are the cremated remains of a treasured home or property being cleared away, and where does it all end up?
Any ash from the fire, any debris, any burned vegetation is being treated as if it contains asbestos.
Cody Lillstrom, Boulder County Zero Waste Manager, has an extra role these days by helping orchestrate the county's debris removal efforts as part of disaster response. Lillstrom explains the complexity of debris removal and waste diversion centers on that nasty substance, asbestos.
A lot of building supplies still contain asbestos in them, though, you know, we haven't been putting asbestos in insulation for decades now. It's still in other building supplies like epoxies and glues, and some sheetrock coatings or drywall coatings have asbestos in them. So when things burn like that in the fire, we got guidance from CDPHE that essentially we just need to assume that all of the fire debris and ash is asbestos containing, and we're treating it as such.
Some property owners of destroyed structures turn to private contractors to get a jump on their rebuilding and recovery efforts. This option seemed especially appealing as Boulder County faced delays and lawsuits challenging its choice of a contractor to handle the publicly funded and large-scale debris removal program. Grand Lake Excavating was one of the first contractors hired directly by property owners in Superior who chose not to sign on to the county's debris removal program. Grand Lake Operations Manager Brad Bauman says they are aware of the asbestos concerns and handle the debris accordingly.
So we've got a control plan in process. When we get here, we'll evaluate the site. We'll run all of our erosion control and BMPs.
And what does that mean, BMP?
Well, it's just keeping all of the ash and debris on your site from getting anywhere else outside of your individual site. Especially if rain, snow, we don't want the runoff. We want our inlet valves to be covered. We just want the process to be as clean as possible to keep the ash in one area. From that point, we'll get our water truck, we'll wet down all the ash, get that concealed into a foundation where the house is burned, so we have one controlled area of where all the ash and debris is at, and then we'll start cleaning the concrete, we'll start cleaning the metal. If there's metal and concrete that we can recycle, we will. If not, it gets shipped off to the landfill with the ash and debris that is treated like hazardous material.
The transport of hazardous materials involves dumping the waste in a semi-truck trailer bed lined and draped with plastic sheeting and then wrapping the material with the same lining. When finished, the wrapped hazardous load looks like a gigantic plastic burrito. Bauman says once the wrapped load meets his company's standards and the requirements of the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, also known as the CDPHE, the truck driver can then place a screen over the load and haul it off to an approved landfill. Shortly after the Marshall Fire, the CDPHE approved the landfills in Commerce City, Erie, Keensburg, and Aurora to accept asbestos or hazardous waste from the Marshall Fire zone. Each load going to a landfill must be accompanied by a manifest, which is a fancy term for a carbon copy form that compiles information on the load, such as weight, the location origin of the waste, what entity generated the waste, and what trucking company is hauling the waste. Bauman says all parties who interact with the load, including the landfill, will sign the manifest.
So at the very end of this process, I'll take all of the manifests and I'll scan them in and then submit them to the county so they can see exactly how much came out of each individual site that we've worked on.
For Grand Lake Excavating, which landfill the waste ends up in often depends on the turnaround time of hauling and the availability of manifest paperwork from a given location. From his own audit observation of landfills, Boulder County's Cody Lilstrom says landfills do handle asbestos loads responsibly.
They were very safe. They dug a hole, buried it in that hole, and covered it back up so that there was no, possibility of anything getting out. So they do take it very seriously.
Another form of contaminated waste that will also be added to the plastic burrito is soil and organic matter from the ash footprint of a destroyed property. Both Lilstrom and Bauman described a process of an initial scrape of 3 to 6 inches of soil from a site. After the initial scrape, different locations at the site will be tested for any remaining heavy metals or other toxins. Pending the outcome of the soil tests, more soil could be removed. Bauman said the lab results by his company's own soil engineer are also compiled and examined by the county. Another big question is if anything can get a second life from a destroyed property, and if so, how much? Cody Lilstrom says it largely depends on the age of the home.
A lot of these homes were built after the time they were used, any sort of asbestos materials in a concrete mixture. So we're pretty confident based on that fact that a vast majority of these basements, the basement concrete, will be recyclable and it will be able to get a second life.
Is there a lot of potential for metals from each burn site?
There aren't as many metals as you might think from a burn site. There's usually, a big I-beam or something like that that supported the flooring or the joists. And then, automobiles that burned out can be recycled, propane tanks that, were in the fire and exploded, unfortunately. And other appliances in the house, like water heaters and furnaces that are made of metal, will be scrapped and recycled.
Another type of Marshall Fire waste that can be diverted from the landfill are burned or damaged trees. The Federal Emergency Management Agency reached out to a biochar facility in Berthoud that heats wood feedstock multiple times the temperature of fire in a gigantic kiln. The kiln can hold 11 cubic yards of wood waste that is heated in a non-oxygenated and vacuumed environment. This process goes on for several hours and is called pyrolysis. The end result is a black, shiny carbon which can be used for commercial purposes like in soil amendments, cleanup material for Superfund sites, and mining remediation. The feedstock that goes in the many kilns at the Berthoud biochar facility include beetle-kill pine trees, trees thinned from forests, pallets, crates, and now burned or damaged trees from the Marshall Fire zone.
We embrace the non-uniform feedstock, and then we keep it at temperature long enough to make sure everything's at the same quality and the same consistency.
James Gaspard, CEO of Biochar Now, says he was told to expect more than 300 truckloads of damaged vegetation from the Marshall Fire. Gaspard, who is proud of his company's clean emissions and many patents, explains more about his company's unique spin in producing biochar that cleans Superfund sites and municipal wastewater.
At the molecular level, when we go through our process, we actually create electrical charges into the wood. So we have, and we're the only carbon, according to the USDA labs, that have both positive and negative charges.
Gaspard says most of the carbon from the biocharred Marshall Fire trees will likely go to a customer that has developed a process for treating gray water handled by water utilities. And with that, if there's one positive that can come from the negative nasty Marshall Fire, is that some of its waste in a new form will help prevent gray water from entering streams and watersheds. Metals and concrete free of asbestos and other contaminants are also expected to get a second life. But for all the other remaining debris, ash, and contaminated soil, it's inevitable it will all end up in the landfill, deeply buried and situated in an enclosed wrap of plastic material that ultimately becomes more waste. Just how much of the waste from the Marshall Fire will have a continued journey or will make its way to an ultimate resting place is information that may take some time to tell. For KGNU, I'm Stacey Johnson.
This reporting series was made possible by a grant from Boulder County's Zero Waste Funding Program. A key part of the transition to renewable energy, solar panels degrade over time. However, they're still good for some purposes. Recently, a group of students at Western Colorado University helped one professor convert discarded solar panels into cell phone chargers. The chargers will go to Ukraine and Poland as part of a relief effort.
Photovoltaic solar panels are expensive. They're also hard to recycle, and their production degrades over time, often resulting in a lifespan of about 20 to 25 years, depending on the purpose. What's more, the amount of solar panel waste in the U.S. is increasing. By the end of the decade, the panels used in the first generation of industrial-sized solar farms will no longer be up for the task. But amongst all those problems, Richard Stromberg and his colleagues found a solution.
So literally we just direct wire the USB port from the O'Reilly's or NAPA or AutoZone directly into the junction box on the photovoltaic module, and then we attach it here, and whoever uses it, all you have to do is point the module at the sun and plug in your USB device.
Stromberg is a professor at Western Colorado University in Gunnison. He's also a PhD student studying the viability of giving discarded solar panels new purpose. He co-founded the nonprofit Equitable Solar Solutions, doing just that. Usually, they partner with housing advocates to provide cheap access to solar. Today, he's invited the college community to help assemble solar-powered USB chargers that will eventually go to Ukraine and Poland. We're on the patio outside the student center. The panels are dented, scratched with paint peeling and other signs of sun damage.
Electrically, these are fine, but we found some issues that we wouldn't want to put on those households because we're not confident they'd last another 20 years. But usable. They're still usable for quite a while, so send them to a war zone. Send them to a refugee area. Let them travel overseas. It's not the end of the world if something gets damaged. But we'll get as much life out of them as possible. And they could last another 20 years, but even if they last just another year over in Ukraine, that's better than nothing. That's better than sending them to the landfill.
Researchers estimate that by the year 2050, discarded solar panels could amount to 78 million tons of what most people would call waste. Stromberg and his colleagues have found a way to turn that stream of waste into not only a product line, but also a humanitarian resource. Campbell Mixon is a Western student and an intern at Equitable Solar Solutions.
These solar panels really just provide access to those who can't afford energy or be connected to the grid. To me, energy is something that, like, it's a basic necessity at this point. It's something kind of like water and food. People shouldn't have to go without it.
Back inside the student center, I talked to Maria Strubel, who's brought her freshman general ed class to help with the project.
What better way to teach social activism and political science than engaging in doing something that will benefit people who are displaced and oppressed? And so we just wanted to get our heads dirty and, like, talk about those issues by doing something about them.
Once the chargers are all put together, Strubel distributes colored markers. The students scrawl messages of courage and doodle peace signs and rainbows. There's even an impressive rendering of the school's mascot, the Mountaineer. The panels still don't look new, but the decorations are an obvious metaphor for their renewed purpose. For KBUT News, I'm Christopher Biddle.
We go now to Chris Moore's weekly commentary, Make Them Hear You.
Make them hear you. Make them hear you.
This
This is Make Them Hear You with ideas how you can have your voice heard before Congress. There is an organization, fivecalls.org, that gives you 5 issues a week you can call Congress about. One of the issues this week is abortion rights. Elite draft majority opinion written by Justice Samuel Alito reveals the Supreme Court may vote to overturn Roe v. Wade, upending 50 years of precedence and around abortion as well as other cases built around the right to privacy that flowed from that legal underpinning. Since the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, confidence in the U.S. Supreme Court has plummeted from 70% to under 50% today among the people, a drastic vote of no confidence strongly affected by their possible decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. If overturned, abortion would immediately become illegal in 23 states and territories. Colorado would be almost surrounded by states banning abortion, and the waiting list at clinics in our state would become overwhelmingly long. Senators are now being asked to pass their version of H.R. 3755 and may feel it must be made to pass by any means possible, even if it means ending the filibuster. Back in September, with a 218 to 211 vote, the House passed the Women's Health Protection Act, H.R. 3755, which would create new federal protections for both providers and patients of abortions. This bill locks in abortion access in every state against restrictions like the 6-week and 15-week bans, mandatory delay periods, biased counseling, and medically unnecessary ultrasounds. The legislation now moves to the Senate for consideration. In many states, fetal heartbeat bills ban abortion at 6 weeks before many people even discover they're pregnant. Some laws make abortion a felony, give states the power to prosecute people over miscarriages, and deny people abortions even after a rape or incest. All 3 of the justices appointed by the Trump administration testified under oath that they respect the precedent of Roe v. Wade. Criminalizing abortion will disproportionately harm pregnant people who are low income and or people of color. Senators will soon vote on legislation that would codify the right to an abortion. Here is a text suggested by fivecalls.org for people advocating for abortion rights in calls to their senators. Hi, my name is, and I'm a constituent from City and Zip. I'm calling to urge the senator not only to vote in favor of H.R. 3755, the Women's Health Protection Act, but to use any means possible to get it passed, including ending the filibuster. With the Supreme Court poised to overturn Roe v. Wade, Congress must codify pregnant people's right to bodily autonomy. And if you're leaving a voicemail, by the way, leave your full street address to ensure your call is tallied. If you have thoughts on the Women's Health Protection Act being reconsidered in the Senate, you can contact your senators. This is Chris Moore with Make Them Hear You.
Time now for Naturally with herbalist Brigitte Mars.
Greetings. Welcome to Naturally. We've been hearing a lot in the media that maybe we should be prepared for food shortages. I don't know, but it doesn't hurt to be prepared. Stuff happens. What would be some good things to stock up on? Well, one of my favorites is chia seeds. You don't need to cook them. They're high in protein, vitamin E, and omega-3s, which is really good for your brain. And if you soak a few tablespoons in water, they soak up 7 times their weight in water, and you can flavor them. They taste very bland, but you can flavor them with honey, maple syrup, tamari, salt, pepper, olive oil, greens. That would be a good thing. Red lentils cook very quickly. That would be another favorite of mine. And brown lentils could be sprouted, just in case you didn't have the ability to cook things. I also think of nut butters as being great. Not so much peanut butter, because it is crop rotated with cotton often. And that's not considered a food crop, so it gets heavily sprayed, but almond butter, tahini would be good to have some of. Think of quinoa. Not only does quinoa cook quickly, but it's high in protein. It doesn't have gluten in it, and it can also be sprouted. Oats would be another great one. Oats also don't need to be cooked. You can soak them. Remember famali and muesli? You can just soak oats overnight, and they're ready to eat. Coconut oil would be another great one, not to eat by itself, but as a fat that stores well. It can also be a one-stop beauty shop, because you can use coconut oil for massage, as a lubricant. if you know what I mean, as the lip balm, many, many good things. I think of apple cider vinegar and honey, because 2 teaspoons of each in a cup of warm water is good for just about anything that is bothersome, stomach ache, headache, hangover, arthritis. I would have some first aid supplies, yes, and some good books on things. I love having a solar cooker. I use it to bake potatoes in, and that works super good. Do you know how to purify water? Where would you go to get water if you needed to? And I would certainly think of having some heirloom seeds. Heirloom seeds are going to produce their own seeds, so that'd be great. And isn't it about time you learn to eat the wild weeds that are offering themselves freely? The lamb's quarter, the dandelion, the purslane. Time to wake up. Smell the weeds. Thanks for joining me, Brigitte Mars, on Naturally. Many blessings.
That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Hannah Stewart. Shannon Young has been our producer. Special thanks to Kiara Damari, James Swenson, Alexis Kenyon, Stacey Johnson, Christopher Biddle, Chris Moore, and Brigitte Mars for their contributions to today's program. Stay tuned for the Hightower Lowdown and then a public affair. That's after these news headlines from the BBC.